Hello, Red Sox and baseball fans everywhere. This is Mel Allen, Yankee Magazine's editor. Well, New England and Red Sox Nation is again celebrating a world championship by our beloved Red Sox. Twice in 4 years, all this after an 86-year drought. After the victory parade in Boston, Fenway Park will again grow silent. We will see winter come and linger, and then spring will come, it always does, and again Fenway will come to life. To put a close on this magnificent 2007 season, I'm going to read an excerpt from John Helliar's Last Day at Fenway Park. It will remind us of how truly sweet this victory is, how close we still are to those moments when we always came so close, but always came up short. We published this in October 1979, 1 year after one of the most heartbreaking games in Red Sox history. Last Day at Fenway Park. The game finally began, one of quiet tension interspersed with bursts of drama. The first came in the second inning when Yastrzemski caught a Ron Guidry fastball flush, stroking it in a long line drive out our way, just fair around the foul pole for a home run. I abandoned the careful nursing of a searing sore throat and was screaming, "Yaz! Yaz!" and less intelligible things, while repeatedly jumping up and down for joy for the first time since I couldn't remember when. Then came the slow accumulation of innings. Bill and I exchanging sporadic shorthand appraisals, Mike Torres after all his stretch drive disappointment mowing down the hated New York Yankees, then the addition of another Boston run in the sixth. The grandstand and light tower shadows were beginning to cut deeply into the field, the sun lowering to the blinding treachery level for right fielders, when in the seventh, New York, for the first time, put together two straight hits. That brought up less than fearsome Bucky Dent, who looked even less fearsome sitting on the ground for several minutes after fouling a pitch off his shin. We were speculating on who would pinch hit when he finally hobbled back to the plate. Torres came to the stretch, looked back at Chambliss on second and over his shoulder at White on first, then pitched. Dent swung and lofted a fly ball toward left. The grandstand overhang blocked its flight from view, and I watched Yastrzemski looking up, as though setting for the catch. Then he turned around, still looking up, and staggered. The ball did not come down. The worst had happened. Fenway Park was silent, except for the pockets of Yankee fans emerging from the closets, on their feet shouting with glee. The score mounted to 5-2 with a Reggie Jackson eighth inning homer, and now I was not so much tired as empty. "It's gone," I said, watching Jackson's well-practiced October Cadillac trot. "I don't know," Bill said bravely. "I think we're going to see a real Garrison finish. It's a pattern of every classic game. Go ahead, fall behind, come storming back." I held my skeptical tongue and watched him proven correct. The game, the season, had one more twist. The league's best reliever, Rich Gossage, had been overpowering on entering the game in the seventh, but Boston was rocking him with singles in the eighth when the revitalized Fenway faithful rocked in approval, Yaz driving in another run, Fisk fighting off fastball after fastball before singling to keep the rally alive before finally George Scott fanned to strand two runners. Still, we were down only 5-4 now, and the top of the ninth was only an occasion for recharging voices. I looked at my scorecard. One batter, just one batter on, and Jim Rice would have another shot. With one out in the last of the ninth, Gossage obligingly walked Rick Burleson. Jerry Remy followed with a line drive to right, and my eyes quickly riveted on Lou Piniella, perhaps 150 feet away, squinting into the sun, standing frozen. "He's lost it," I shrieked. A piece of intelligence unfortunately lost on Burleson, rooted between first and second. The ball hopped directly to Piniella, and he threw toward third. Burleson rounded second, then came skidding to a halt and retreated. Now the wildest fantasy I could have spun way back in March, when I was listening to the first exhibition game on the car radio. The snow stacked high on either side of Route 2 was unfolding, the whole season coming down to Rice and Yastrzemski, coming to bat with a tying and winning runs aboard. "Swing at the first one and I'll personally strangle you," I hissed as Rice stepped in. For fearsome hitter as he is, he often does not wait for the optional pitch. He watched the first pitch go by, but the best he could do then was fly deep enough to right to move Burleson to third. And then there was one. The roar rolled down from the stands and tumbled over the field as Yastrzemski came out of the on-deck circle, the noise swelling to a near insupportable din as he approached the plate. Yaz, 39 years old, a rookie when I saw my first game, the one link to all that history since. Everyone in the ballpark was standing now for this final exquisite agony, our best against theirs, another season of giddy highs and abysmal lows, all hanging in the balance in the black bay gloaming. Bill and I looked at each other and shook our heads slightly, beyond words. I rolled up my scorecard into a tight baton and turned back toward the plate. It is funny what you notice and recall. I looked up at the spectator standing along the left field roof, silhouetted against the sky like elongated pigeons. Goose Gossage was ready. The first pitch rode in, and 32,925 people winced. Ball one. The crowd roared anew, and a thought sprang loose in my mind. My God, this could happen. I was suddenly assaulted with mixed feelings. Could I handle winning? Had I become so adept at rationalizing close but no cigar, so comfortable with second-guessing and speculating, that I didn't in my heart of hearts want anything else? Did I want it to end cleanly and honorably right now so that I would not have to face the pressures of a stake in the World Series? I was, after all, the one who missed Carlton Fisk's legendary foul pole home run in 1975 because I had gone to bed, unable to endure the tension. On the mound, Gossage was looking for a sign. And then another random thought. Bobby Thompson, he of the 1951 playoff-winning homer for the New York Giants. I had always envied Giants fans the eternal ecstasy of that moment. Had run through many a daydream of something like it in Fenway one day. Now the day was here, and I was thinking, no thanks? I looked out at Paul Blair in center, waiting, and pictured Yaz ramming one over his outstretched glove. Remy would be flying around the bases for the winning run. I would be pounding on Bill. He would be pounding on me, and the general eruption would make the 67 homer seem like afternoon tea at the Copley. I decided with an exhaled heave of breath, I could take a stab at living with victory. Gossage set and fired again. Yastrzemski uncoiled a full swing, and I could not see where the ball had gone. Then I saw Gossage jumping up and down on the mound, and beyond him, third baseman Nettles backpedaling. I was thinking, Bill said in a darkened Brattleboro, Vermont bar months later. I was thinking I saw Brooks Robinson drop one just like that in 1970. But Nettles did not drop it. And within seconds, the tableau between batter and pitcher had dissolved into a swarm of joyful Yankees near third base, the cheers of Yankee fans echoing thinly around the park, while the rest of us were abruptly gagged. John Kiley started playing the organ, and with that cue, the park emptied quickly. It was as though you had pulled the plug on something. Bill and I stayed put, staring at the people bunched up in the aisles, and passed them at the line of ushers and cops around the perimeter of the field, unaccountably guarding against an invasion of jubilant fans. I started filling out my scorecard box score methodically, deliberately totaling the at-bats, runs, hits, and RBIs, trying to make the statistics a cushion against all else. The score came out the same every way I added it. Finally, the ushers started moving in on the stragglers, and Bill and I got up slowly and headed for the exit. I went down the ramp and away from the 1978 season without the usual last lingering look. I knew I already had the vision that would stay with me. It was the frozen twilight moment as Yaz walked to the plate through the gathering din. The sudden collision of all memory and hope, the confrontation cementing the game's place as a classic, the setting from which I would spin my dreams of different endings. Outside Fenway, the day had lost most of its sparkle. Commuter and ballgame traffic had met and snarled. The smell of exhaust and the blasts of horns were rising to meet the first leaves falling from the trees along Park Drive. Bill finally spoke. "It was the best game I ever saw," he said. "The best," I said. There was nothing else to add, and we walked along in silence. I was wondering why Remy's hit had to bounce to the blinded Pinella, neat as you please. I was wondering why storybook endings hardly ever happened outside storybooks. And I was wondering, just like every other year, why winter had to come so soon. This is Mel Allen, and to read and listen to other Red Sox classics from Yankee Magazine, go to yankeemagazine.com. Thanks for listening.